Anyway, now that'll set it off, I think. Perhaps I had that.
But could you tell me what she aimed to do? Did she want eventually to write an autobiography, do you think? I mean, a published autobiography?
Yes, she did. I'm not sure how long she'd wanted to do that, probably for a very long time, but she didn't really get down to it until after my father died. Not seriously. And very shortly after that she became seriously ill herself.
I see, so she only had this, sort of created a fragment of what would have been a proper autobiography.
She'd been making notes and collecting cuttings and things like that for a long time, but she hadn't really started putting it together.
Yes, I certainly had the impression, I mean, if you go to the Fawcett Library, I imagine you gave it to the Fawcett Library, did you? It is quite a heap of stuff, and there's quite a lot of stuff there. Which suggests that for the early years, anyway, she wrote several drafts. I mean, not just one draft, but several. Yes. But do you think did she have to be sort of persuaded into writing about herself? Do you think, or was she quite keen to write about herself?
I think she was quite keen, and she wanted to link it up with what had happened about feminism since the end of the suffrage movement, and what hadn't happened, and why it hadn't happened.
That's precisely what I would like to do in relation to her. I mean, I think, you know, one of her points was, in the whole argument, that it's no good getting the vote unless you train up women to use it properly.
Exactly.
And her argument for democratic women's suffrage movement was geared entirely towards that. So I very much sympathise with that view, you know. So that's one reason why I find her a very congenial person. But so anyway, she wrote these. She was collecting stuff and writing. Was she for, say, the last 10 years of her life?
Or? Oh, I should think quite that.
So. Could you tell me a bit? I mean, could you tell me a bit about your father? You see, I don't know who she married or anything. I mean, I really do pretty well stop about 1911. So could you tell me what happened after 1911? It's a big question.
Well, my father was. I suppose at one time he would have called himself a philosophical anarchist.
Yes.
But he was involved with the Manchester University settlement people, and they met at a holiday fellowship that was run by the Manchester University settlement. He was a Scot, came from Aberdeen.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, could I start you again on that? she married
in 1907.
Yes.
That was about the time of the split, so that there was a break from the suffrage movement. But she still did some lecturing after that, because, you know, part of my childhood memories are of stories of her travelling on Sundays by very inconvenient trains and having to break her journey here and there, and she also was involved in a railway accident in Northern Ireland when she was doing some lecturing over there. But under whose auspices it was, I'm not sure.
Yes, I remember reading about an accident around about 1910, I think, in the periodicals. Yes.
She was still writing then. She wrote for the New Age as well as the Guardian. And then the war came along, and that upset her very much, and I don't think she did anything in the public line for a time. And then in the middle of the war I came along, so that occupied her very fully for the next few years. Then I think the next organisation she got involved with was after we came down to London. And that was something called the Sports Fellowship, which was intended to encourage women's full participation in sports of every kind, and also It was part of the movement for getting playing fields and sporting facilities for underprivileged children and things like that. It never really achieved very much, so far as I can remember. And then there was the Women's Billiards Association, that also occupied her a lot. Partly that was because my father was the managing director of Burroughs and Watts, the billiard table manufacturers. And then there was Women for Westminster, and that went on for years and years, but you see how little that's achieved. And the Married Women's Association, and there was a women's business and professional luncheon club, something rather like the Sir Optimists. And during the Second War, there was Richard Ackland's Commonwealth Association.
Oh, she was
in that. But all of them took up a tremendous amount of her time and energy and effort, and from all of them she withdrew because she had come to disbelieve in the methods that were being used to promote them, usually because apart from her firm belief in complete democratic participation, she was also quite unable to accept that the end justified the means. The means had to be impeccable. And of course they very seldom are in any successful organisation or political party. So most of these efforts ended in some kind of quarrel or breach, and a great deal of heart burning for her because she was an extremely vulnerable person. I always thought she had one skin too few.
That's extremely interesting. I mean, in a sense, that vindicates the Pankhurst position, doesn't it? I mean, to put it crudely.
Yes.
But the thing is, the Pankhurst were so ruthless in their methods that, I mean, there are limits. I think that most of us would agree. You know, like burning down houses and that sort of thing, one doesn't really go in for a decent society. But still, that is very interesting, and if I may say so, I'm surprised that you are able to be as objective as that about your mother. I mean, I would have thought that that you might not have been able to make that point, because, you know, that's almost a sort of point that I could have made as an outsider very easily, but as someone who knew your mother so well, I'm rather admiring for me to say that.
I grew up in a very political family. You know, we were always involved with the reforming movements of the time. And Jimmy Maxton, Keir Hardie, of course, died before I was born, but his brother George and Manny Shimwell and all these people were in and out of the house, Dallas. And Ramsay MacDonald. And well, I was thinking politically very early. And I think partly because of this, and partly because I was so fond of my mother, and I felt so angry when I saw her suffering for what I thought was a trivial organisation, because really most of these were, the basic idea was all right, but you know, they seemed so small and petty. That I had to think about why these things were happening to them.
Yes. But it would be easy to take the sort of position of either sort of uncritical championing of your mother, wouldn't it? And then sort of, you know, just supporting her all the way through in a sort of loyal but it would seem to me unintelligent way, or to be as fair-minded as you obviously are about your mother, but sometimes presumably did this involve you in having arguments with her about this sort of point, or didn't you feel able to make these sorts of point with her?
Oh yes, I was brought up by her to be almost too rational. She was too rational. At least she thought she was.
She thought
could be totally rational and that everybody should be totally rational. Do you smoke?
I don't think you do smoke yourself if you like to.
So we discussed everything, and I was brought up to argue and reason about everything, including people. Mm. So that's probably why I couldn't do this about her.
Mm.
The totally emotional, unthinking support would have been definitely disapproved of.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean that I'm not, I mean I'm not now, but I wasn't then emotional about it, but my emotion was hatred of the other, as I thought, petty people who were doing the things that were hurting her, and you know, my reaction would be, well, for God's sake, get out of the stupid organisation and get back to writing, which is what you should be doing.
Yes, I'm sure you're right on that, actually. I just wish she had written more now. But you say that she knew she was too rational, something like that, you said.
No, I don't think she knew it. She thought that you could be completely rational and that everything should be completely rational. And, you know, when the world was, most of our troubles would disappear. She couldn't really accept that nobody is completely rational, and that the non-rational elements are often the most important ones, the most powerful ones in your life.
How did your father relate to that, sort of set of attitudes in her?
On the surface, very well. He would have liked to have been equally rational, but he was the sort of person who can't always argue about the things that matter most to him, and he could sulk. He could sulk for days on end. And we used to have very bitter arguments latterly about the way the trade union movement was going, because having been a staunch supporter of trade unionism in its youth, he couldn't accept that it was now becoming as much of a tyranny as the employer. And of course, with two women arguing with him on the opposite side, he would just retreat into saying nothing for days. That was his retreat. They both, in a way, had not quite well deprived childhoods, I suppose, would cover it. My mother's, I don't quite remember how much about her childhood she put in her memoirs.
Quite a lot about her relations with her mother.
But not much about her father.
No, there's quite vivid descriptions of this, what Blackburn was like and Preston was like, and you know, the clogs on the street day after work and all that sort of thing. A lot about sort of really, I suppose you could say, the awfulness of childhood. You know, I mean, of not so much she was badly treated or anything, but just she wanted to be independent and she wanted to get away from this constricting, particularly her mother's Catholicism. Keeps on coming up.
Oh, it does, and I think it had a profound effect on her. I think that's one of the reasons why she had one skin too few. Because my theory is that if you're brought up a Catholic, it must be terribly, terribly difficult to get rid of this confession and absolution business, and that then the guilt that you've been taught to feel has no channel. You can't get rid of it, so it spreads over everything. It certainly did with her. She could feel guilty about more things than anybody I've ever met. You know, if somebody injured her, she felt guilty. It must be her fault in some way. But she had a very unhappy childhood because her parents were so unhappy. Her mother should never have married. She wanted to be a nun, but they wouldn't let her be a nun because they said she wasn't sufficiently stable. She'd better go away and get married. And so their sexual relationships were very unhappy, and my grandfather felt that he'd been cheated, because I think his real reason for wanting to marry her was that he expected her to be something of an heiress, because her father had the first department store in Preston. However, he didn't leave as much to her as had been anticipated, and the year before he died, the Married Women's Property Act was passed, so it was her money and not my grandfather's. Very unfortunate.
Yes,
wouldn't let
him rather
have
unfair
it.
Life, wasn't it?
Yes. So, well, my mother despised her father, and although she did find her mother's Catholicism very restricting and painful, she was very, very fond of her mother. So this was an unbalanced and unhappy childhood. You said the awfulness of childhood. And this, I think, is it. And you know, it's something that brings me up with a shock, because the awfulness of childhood.
One tends to slur it over as an adult. One forgets it, doesn't one? But you certainly got a very vivid impression of it there. Particularly her account of running away, of course.
Yes.
And the sort of terrible loneliness of it. Her life was, in many ways, rather like, I don't know if you've read that book, The Hard Way Up, by Hannah Mitchell, have you?
No.
So it's in many ways very similar to your mother's history, in that they were both rebels and both ran away from home and were both in the industrial north and socialistic in their sort of views, idealistic, and one suspects a bit difficult to get on with in some ways. You know, there are many parallels. It's just that Hannah Mitchell carried on her autobiography later. It was published about 1968 or so. It's a very good book, actually.
That's
I recommend
fine.
It if you like reading biographies and things. But, I mean, you really are filling out the picture very helpfully, actually. Could you tell me a bit more about your father's personality? You say he, in a sense, retreated into Sucks, you know. Was that really, do you think, because earlier on in life, in their married life, he realised that she could beat him in argument, and so this was the only way, in a sense, to hang on to your opinions?
No, I think it started much earlier than that, in his own childhood, because his mother died when he was 7, and he had 4 sisters, and his father was totally unsatisfactory as a father. He ignored his children most of the time and beat them if they were a nuisance to him. So they grew up wild, as it were, in the country in Aberdeenshire. And my father, you see, was totally surrounded by females. He had 2 elder sisters, 2 younger sisters and a housekeeper. And I think that it was his retreat, it was his way out then, when the women got too much for him.
I
was
see.
Just to retreat into silence. There's a story about him when, in his youth, when he was sharing digs with a cousin and they quarrelled about something or other. And they didn't speak to each other for 18 months, but they shared the same bedroom with the same sitting room and ate their meals together. Quite incredible. He was a gentle person. Very much liked by children. Very popular with women too. I always think he should have been an academic. He won a scholarship to Marshall College in Aberdeen, but wasn't allowed to take it up because my grandfather wouldn't sign the form which indicated what his income was. He wasn't telling those Parkers in Aberdeen that. But this was the year before the final year at which you could win the scholarship, so the Dominie worked on my grandfather for the next year, and father won another place at the end of that year. And my grandfather would then have signed the form, but unfortunately they'd moved just outside the geographical boundary. So, if he'd got there, I'm sure he would have gone on to university, and I think he would have become an academic, because that's where his interest lay. But instead of that, he had to go out to work at 14, and he finished up in the world of business, which was not his métier at all. He could compromise more than my mother could. but he too was a means must be worthy of the end person, and strictly honest, which isn't always happy in business.
Did he have a strong sort of religious background? Were they Presbyterians?
Yeah, they were Presbyterians, but just in name. You know, they didn't, it didn't make much difference to them personally. But of course, in the country, in Scotland, then the whole atmosphere was Scottish Presbyterian, whether you really cared about it.
Of course, yeah.
Did more than nominally go to the kirk. It was the way you had to live your life. So the Scottish Presbyterian background and the Catholic background made, even though they both left them,
yes,
I think, made quite a different attitude to life. It's difficult for the child of a marriage, I think, unless it really breaks down, to know how happy or unhappy their parents were, but I think on the whole it was a good marriage.
They were both not agnostics exactly, but they were both, didn't go to church.
They were both atheists.
Were they? Were they quite militant about that? I mean,
oh, no.
Fierce?
No, not at all. No. Everybody had a right to their own views.
Yes, I see. Yes. What do you think they had in common then? They had a sort of rather unhappy childhood in common, didn't they? And their irreligion in common, I suppose. Did your mother or your father talk about how they met and you know, do you now see how they came together?
Well, I know how they met, and they spent quite a lot of time together at this holiday fellowship. This was when mother was teaching in Manchester and father was working there, and they went most weekends out on this to Derbyshire with a group of similarly interested people, all quite young. And that's where they got to know each other. Latterly, when we used to motor up to Scotland for holidays, we always had to go through Derbyshire and spend a couple of nights there. And it was an absolute nightmare to me, because I would drive them around to various places that they'd known in their youth, and every now and then one or other of them would say, "Now go slowly here, go more slowly. Now that gate, friend, do you remember when we leant over that gate and we had an argument about so-and-so? And it didn't matter what the traffic was doing, you know, I had to slow down or stop." And, you know, all sorts of parts of Derbyshire they could remember, what they discussed when they were there and who else was there and what they'd done before and afterwards. Why they fell in love with each other, I don't know. As I say, my father was always attractive to women. He always had a lot of women who were interested in him. Mother was engaged when they met to another man. So it must just be this thing called love.
Yes, they were in love, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
Yes. I mean, very often one grows to a deep affection in marriage, you know. I mean, I think it's rather a myth that everybody's in love.
Oh, so do I, yes.
But they really were in love.
Yes, they were in love, yes.
Yes. Do you actually know who she was engaged to before?
A man called John Gandy Buick.
I haven't come across
him. Anything about him.
He wasn't, was he in the same holiday group? I see. What were they doing, actually? Were they just talking in the country, like the Fabians or something, or were they...
Oh, no, I don't think it was as serious as that. They were a group of people who all had some interest in common, and I think some connection with Manchester University settlement.
I see.
And they did have a cottage at Hayfield for some years, which presumably they rented for the summer, and they went out there and walked and...
talked,
drank and
argued.
Went to the penny gaff.
Yes,
and
I
that
see.
Sort of thing.
Yes, I see.
So we were all busy putting the world to rights.
Yes, yes. There's a tremendous amount of idealism among young people there, which, in a way, doesn't exist quite in the same way now. In the sense that now, young people don't argue so much. They have a separate culture of their own, which is to some extent irrational. Or some aspects of it anyway seem to be irrational. You probably know more about it than I do. But there's not that sort of puritanical earnestness about young people now that was then.
No, they don't want to. I think they've given us up, haven't they?
I wonder what your mother would have thought of them, actually. She probably would be a bit disappointed. Well,
I think she'd have been terribly shocked by some of them. I don't mean their morals or their dress, though their dress would have upset her. But their complete lack of any sense of responsibility or duty, which some young people seem to have. Perhaps not the very young. I'm thinking more of the young professionals I know who don't seem to feel that they have any responsibility towards their employers or the people that they're working for.
That's interesting.
But on the other hand, you have the younger still. I do think that the ones in their 20s, some of them, they don't talk about it, but they do far more for other people in a completely natural way, certainly than we did.
Yes, actually, in relation to marriage, for instance, I think there's much more cooperativeness between husband and wife among younger couples in the world. I mean, there are some very progressive, I'm sure your mother would have approved of that.
Oh, for yes.
But still, there's a sort of... I don't know whether I can express it, but there seems to be a sort of intense integrity about some people, particularly brought up in religious backgrounds in the very early 20th century, of course throughout the 19th century, which has now vanished. I mean, that sort of intense self-analysis and very high standards of conduct, which now don't seem to me to exist, really. It's curious. Still, your father was already in business, was he, when he met your mother?
Yes.
I mean, he was working in Manchester in some sort of business firm, was he? And then he... what was his sort of career? Can you sort of explain, or is it very complicated?
Well, he started out as an errand boy, and then he became one of these insurance agents who go around collecting threepence a week from everybody on their book. In those days he was still in Aberdeen. Then he went down to Glasgow. I'm not quite sure what he did at first, nor am I quite sure what he was doing in Manchester. But eventually he was in Burroughs and Watts in Glasgow, and he became the manager of that branch. And then during the war, the First World War, he became the fuel controller for the Glasgow area, where he was very unpopular with some people, because he would give coal to a church that was doing various things for people and using its building for the welfare of the neighbourhood, and he wouldn't give it to some club which felt that the comfortable and well-heeled businessmen ought to have their comfortable club to go to. And then he went back to Burroughs and Watts after the war. And then a few years after that, in the early 20s, he was offered the curatorship of a museum in Glasgow, which must have been a sheer bit of nepotism, I suppose, because his brother-in-law was then the provost. But, I mean, he had no qualifications whatever for the job. He would have loved it, and he would have equipped himself in his own way, but he had no qualifications. However, at just that time, he was also offered a joint managing directorship of the whole of Burroughs and Watts, and a move down to London. And I had bronchitis every winter from the year of my birth, and the doctor had said to my mother, you must get her out of this climate. So mother said, we must go to London. So we came to London.
That was when?
That was 1925-26.
It was a London firm, was it?
Yes.
With a Glasgow
with
branch.
Branches all over.
Yes, I see. Yes. So he stayed there in that position?
He stayed there until about 1930, when he was chucked out at a moment's notice, having antagonised various important members of the board. And then he started a little station as shop in Carnaby Street. Carnaby Street, as it then was. And that didn't do very well. And finally, he was the secretary of the London Rotary Club, of which he'd been a member for years. And he was still doing that when he died.
Mm. When did he die, actually?
1961.
I see, so he died about 3 years before.
About 3 years before.
Yes, I see.
Mm. And she was a most remarkable. Nobody guessed that she was 80, over 80, when he died. But she became an old woman in a week.
Did she really?
Mm.
Mm. So you realise then how attached she was to him in a way?
Mm.
Even if you hadn't realised it before, you would have done.
Oh yes, I knew that they were both. There were times when she talked about going away and getting off by herself and writing, as if we stopped her writing. but I didn't think she would ever do it. I'm quite sure they couldn't have separated.
No, that's very interesting. So, your mother was really sort of a mother and a housekeeper in a way all her life after you were born anyway, until she died. She didn't ever have a job at all, is that right?
She didn't ever have a full-time paid job. My father went off to do something in Canada for Burroughs and Watts for about 6 months. That must have been in the early 30s. Or the late 20s, and she took over his job then.
Did she?
Hmm.
That shows.
I don't suppose that was very popular either.
Mm, that's rather remarkable thing to do, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. Mm. And no, she didn't ever have a paid job. But of course, all these things she worked for took her out of the house a great deal. And took up a great deal of her time.
Mm.
I think she sometimes felt that if she hadn't been our mother, and she wouldn't have had to be a housewife, and she might have got on with the writing that she wanted to do. But I think that was a rationalisation.
Yes, you get precisely the same thing in Hannah Mitchell. I mean, she keeps on, she thinks of herself anyway as straining to get out of the house and write if she wants to write the sort of article all the time, and she can't get away. I think probably in her case, her husband was a bit ununderstanding, and I'm sure your father was more understanding of this. Well, as you say, he obviously was. So I think in probably Hannah Mitchell's case, it was a more genuine inability to combine writing and being a housewife. Of course, the time when your mother was alive, really, it was still normal for a middle-class woman not to have a job, wasn't it? I mean,
oh, it was, yes.
It's only really rather recent, isn't it?
But until the Second War, we had a resident housekeeper all the time. And I was at school, and father was not by any means a demanding husband from the point of view of how the house was kept or what its meals were like, and really there wasn't any reason why she couldn't have written for at least half of every day. And after that, well, I was grown up and doing my share of the housekeeping and cooking and so on, and again, she could have.
Why didn't she then, do you think?
I never understood it. I sometimes wonder whether it was because these other things that she got herself involved in, she really had to force herself to do. Partly she felt that the suffrage movement had left everything in the air, and nobody was building on what had been achieved, and somebody should be. partly also, as I say, I think she really hated speaking, and she hated the kind of arguments, discussions, attempts to manipulate other people that you have to do in all societies. And I sometimes wonder whether it wasn't a self-inflicted punishment, stemming back to this profound sense of guilt.
Yes, that's extraordinarily interesting. Yes. You say that she had arguments with your father about trade unionism, for instance, towards the end of her life.
We both did.
Yes. In a sense, that's, well, in a rather superficial sense, that's going back on her origins, isn't it? I mean, in the sense she starts off very much an enthusiast for the trade union movement, and if what you say is so, at the end of her life she's turning into an enemy of it, and that's a superficial contrast or contradiction, isn't it? What do you think was really going on? I mean, do you think really there's a certain consistency in those in the attitude of her as a child or as a young woman and in her old age, simply an enthusiasm for individual freedom or for no group organising themselves too powerfully to promote their own self-interest? I mean, what do you think? Do you think there is a consistency between the two positions, really?
Yes, I do. What you've just said, no group organising themselves too powerfully.
And
you see, she wasn't opposed to trade unions as such, she was opposed to what some of the trade unions were doing, as surely we all are.
Yes.
And the sort of things that we would argue about would be one group of trade unions having achieved some advantage for themselves, but this business of the differentials, you know, that chap down there who's getting £6 a week, well, what now, £12 a week less than you, he mustn't be allowed to come anywhere near you.
Mm.
I mean, his wage is not a living wage, but bother that, he's not got to have one penny more nearer to your salary than you're paying
him. So in a way, the conflict between the trade union movement and the egalitarianism of the labour movement was one that influenced your mother quite a lot. I mean, she was presumably, theoretically anyway, an egalitarian, I'm not sure. She presumably despised these artificial distinctions.
Yes.
Yes, I see. Yes, that's interesting. Whereas your father, presumably he must have taken the point, didn't he? But he must.
Oh
have
yes, he accepted the point, but he felt that you couldn't expect them to do anything else because of their long history of being downtrodden and deprived and so on. That they must.
Sort of defensive.
It had got to be much more evened before you could expect them to hold back themselves.
Yes. Did your mother actually organise anything? I mean, with her propensity for some organising things, did she try to actually organise any movement about this, or was it just in conversation, really?
Oh, it was just in conversation.
Yeah, it's very interesting that was so. I hadn't realised that. What do you think about social class position of your two parents? I mean, were they rough? I mean, it's awfully difficult to talk about class in Scotland, isn't it? But I mean, were they roughly the same sort of class level?
I should think so. My grandmother, my mother's mother, of course, thought herself every inch a lady. But my grandfather, he was a shipping clerk. His father was a chartist. That's a you know, it goes back that far.
Her great grandfather. Yes, I think she mentions that in her memoir somewhere.
And for part of his working life, he was organising the provisions for building railways in Ireland and Africa and Canada. So he was a very lively man. My father's mother was a teacher, and his father was a saddler. So I suppose they're
about the same.
About the same.
And that, there was
there was never any real poverty in my mother's childhood, I think. They sometimes had to be careful, but there was never any question about not getting enough to eat. And the children sometimes had to wear the stock because my grandmother spent her money in setting up little businesses with baby clothes and wool and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But in my father's childhood there was extreme poverty at times.
That would be another sort of common ground between them, I suppose. She would presumably be, she would identify with someone who'd been in extreme poverty, wouldn't she, in general, I would have thought. How did she get on with her relatives? I mean, she had a number of brothers and sisters, didn't she, as far as I remember?
She had two sisters and a brother.
Yes. Did she get on with them all right, do you think?
She was very fond of her elder sister when they were young. But she didn't see very much of her after Beatrice married, I think because she didn't approve of her husband, and still less did she approve of the fact that Beatrice had nine children, one after the other.
What did she disapprove of the husband about? I mean,
well, there'd been another man who wanted to marry her, Beatrice, who was a teacher and mother-like very much, and thought would have made a better husband than this Roger Cook, who was a coop, who was a fine, upstanding, handsome, lively, attractive man, but very weak, and he later became an alcoholic, so but his mother's judgment of him was quite right.
An irrational marriage, I suppose.
Well, again, this thing called love.
Yes.
Because the other man apparently was a very nice and kind and intelligent and had been anxious to marry Beatrice for a long time. Well, she didn't see very much of her at all after. As a matter of fact, I think I'll come back to that, if I may, when we're not recording.
Yes, of course. Would you like me to switch off now?
Yes, if you like. And every time I was introduced to someone, they used to say, and what is it like to have such a wonderful woman for your mother? Well, I mean, that's a completely unanswerable question, because how do I know what it was like to have any other woman for my mother, you know? And also, of course, I wasn't really interested. I suppose this started when I was about nine. And so I rather shut it out.
Yes, as I say, I mean, in a way, what interests me, what you're asking you, is afterwards, really. So, I mean, that suits both. Did your mother actually, though, talk about, for instance, did she talk much about her relations with the Pankhursts in later life? I mean, did she go back to it a lot or harp on it, or was she obsessed with it in any way?
No, I don't think so. She may have been earlier. In fact, I think she probably was for the first few years after it had happened. But she would talk about it if somebody asked her. But I don't remember that.
It didn't keep on coming up. That's interesting. But did she read sort of histories of the suffragette movement and sort of get indignant when they got it wrong, sort of thing? I mean, she was interested enough from that point of view, wasn't she? Because you say, I mean, I gather you watched the television broadcast, shoulder to shoulder. She was a major figure.
Yes.
And she didn't appear as such in those programmes.
No.
And as you say, I mean, her role wasn't limited to making the tea. She was much more than that. She would have been justifiably cross, I think.
I think she would have been, because she was at least as important as Annie Kenney until the time of the split.
Certainly. She was an important figure, well, she was the major figure in the Women's Freedom League up till leaving them, because that's another organisation she left in 1911. And the thing, I can obviously be quite frank with you, the thing that I regret about her is that when you read her reasons for leaving organisations, she's such an intelligent woman, so analytic and in a sense rational, that she explains in completely frank and sharp terms why she's doing what she's doing, And you can just imagine the reaction of people she's been working with to being spoken about in this way. It's not exactly, well, it is, I think, yes, it is really. It's not just a rational explanation of why she's leaving. It's quite an emotional explanation in a way, quite sharp tone sort of explanation she'd have. I don't know whether that was so later on in life, but you can understand from these explanations she offers why she had trouble in organisations. It's rather sad, really. But do you think she learned from that? I mean, did she look back over her life and see herself as having resigned from a lot of organisations or had a lot of trouble? Did she look back and become self-critical at all?
I don't think she did. She looked back and regretted that she hadn't achieved anything. But I don't think she saw it in those terms. And it went through everything. I mean, she was quite without small talk, and she couldn't tell white lies, and she couldn't hide the fact that she was bored. I think she may have seen that, because one of the things that she used to talk about when she was feeling depressed after my father died was that she'd been a handicap to him in his work, because she hadn't been able to do the sort of entertaining of business colleagues which was expected of managing directors' wives, and at functions. She wasn't popular because she couldn't sit and chat about whatever trivia was interesting the people she was with. She made it very plain that she was bored to death. And she wouldn't refrain from making a comment about the news of the day or something somebody said,
regardless
which
of what
the rest of us would have held back.
Of course, her views wouldn't have fitted with the views of a managing director or the people he was likely to mix among, or with the world of billiards, I wouldn't have thought, do you think? I mean,
well, I don't think that it mattered so much in the billiard players' part of the billiard world. Certainly she wasn't cut out to be the wife of a man in business.
Though, as you present things, she wasn't really a hindrance in the sense that your father...
Well, he wasn't cut out for it either.
No, precisely.
So that, I mean, he it didn't worry him really that that his wife didn't do the sort of things that other people's wives did, and he would much rather have had her as she was than have that kind of a wife.
Yes. What was her attitude to the home? I mean, to for instance, could you describe how she brought you up?
Well, as I've said, extremely rationally. Everything was explained and reasoned and argued out, which I used to find very frustrating as a small child, because I couldn't argue back and I felt sure that I had just as good reasons for doing what I wanted to do, but I couldn't express them, you see. Well, she was an extremely loving and devoted mother, and I had lots of freedom and lots of stimulation and a total feeling of security from both of them, and a very happy childhood.
Did she have views about your education? I mean, how you should be educated?
Well, I think that they had a lot of heart-searching as to whether they should send me to a progressive school, but they decided that they wouldn't, because it was still something of an oddity, and made you something of an oddity to have been to one. But for a brief period during the Second World War, Mother did some teaching at King Alfred's and was very impressed with it. I think then she may have regretted it.
King Alfred's, I don't know.
It's at in Hampstead, and it's a progressive day school. I don't know whether it still exists. But they sent me to ordinary conventional schools. I went to a kindergarten at 3, which wasn't, I suppose, ordinary in those days.
No.
But I loved that, being an only child. And then I went to Glasgow High, and then when we came down here, I went to Henrietta Barnett first, which is also in Hampstead, and then to North London Collegiate.
Did you? Yes.
They didn't want me to have religious education at first. They wanted me to be old enough to make up my own mind. So I didn't go to prayers or scripture lessons at Henrietta Barnett. And I did feel very odd because all the other little girls said, "Are you a Catholic?" And I said, "No." "Are you a Jew?" "No." "Well, what are you then?"
That's probably calculated to make you religious, in fact.
It didn't.
It could easily have that effect, couldn't it?
But when I changed schools, I said, "Please can I go to prayers and scripture?" So they said I could.
So, I mean, in a way, you seem to have had a very normal education. And as far as your mother in the house, I mean, did she... What was she like in the house? Was she house proud? Did she cook a lot? I mean, what?
She was a good, plain cook. She didn't like fussing around with sauces and decorating things very much. But she was an excellent cook of ordinary roasts and stews and puddings and... all the ordinary basic things. House proud, well, things should be clean and comfortable and reasonably tidy, but that was all.
And you say she had a house, what was a housekeeper?
She had a resident housekeeper, yes.
Yeah, so that must have helped a bit.
Yes, and she did all the donkey work.
What about gardening and things like, and hobbies? I mean, presumably her hobbies were really her movements.
Hobbies? Well, no, she was a carpenter. She loved making things. Had she been a man, I think she would have done something with her hands. But if she got two bits of wood and some screws, she was happy.
Is there anything in this room, for instance, which she made?
There's nothing in this room. There's nothing very... I've got a little box in my bedroom that she made, which I use to put my tea, morning tea on.
But this was a sort of hobby, really.
Yeah, it was a hobby,
she liked creating things.
And she liked painting. Oh, the chairs. Yes, she recovered our dining chairs several times.
Did she? Not for economy, but because she liked doing
things. Yeah, because she liked doing it.
Was she puritanical in her attitude to time, for instance? And was she concerned about wasting time at all? Or was she always in a hurry or anything like that?
No. She was very interested in natural beauty. She liked just driving through beautiful bits of the country when she was no longer able to just walk through them. And she liked flowers and birds and animals. And she liked reading. I don't remember her doing nothing very much when I was younger, but when she was old, she was quite happy to just sit and contemplate something beautiful for hours on end.
Was she really? Yes. Did she? She read quite a lot, did she?
Yes.
She was a highly intellectual woman, really, wasn't she? I mean, she gives the impression to me that she was.
Yes. They had that in common too. Of course, they both had utterly inadequate educations and should have both gone to university.
And would now, of course.
Of course, that was a bit of a trial to me, in that they both wanted me to do and enjoy and have all the things that they hadn't. And therefore, I should come top of the class in everything, really, except scripture, didn't mind about that.
Sounds as if your childhood could have been rather a trial. In fact, it doesn't seem to be.
No, it wasn't at all. I always came home with my Tony report with my heart in my mouth, because I knew they'd be so disappointed with it. I never. I mean, I often had first places in English and history and very good comments about that. But I never brought home a school report they were satisfied with, because there was always something I could have done better at. And this, I was a bit resentful about this at the time, but as I grew older and realised what they had both missed and what they were making possible for me, I understood it better.
Yes. Is there anyone else, I mean, apart from Mrs. Blackman and the relative in Canada, who you think I ought to see? I mean, you mentioned, I switched on again now, you mentioned Beatrice and that sort of relationship. She had another sister, did you say she had?
Oh, yes, she had a younger sister, Carrie, who came very much at the end of the family and was very spoilt and grew up to expect that everything would be just the same in her adult life as it had been in her childhood. And so was a very unhappy woman, because she didn't, you know, the fairy prince didn't come along. A very nice man came along, but he didn't turn out to be a fairy prince. And she didn't live in a castle and have servants to do things. And she had two sons very rapidly. And then her husband died of cancer, all in about 4 years. And she had a permanent grudge against life from then on. So we were in touch with her. We saw her from time to time. My father couldn't stand her. And I got very tired of her, because you do get tired of people who are always grumbling and complaining. But Mother, again, she felt guilty about Clary. But she died just before Mother. And I don't know where the boys are.
But your mother's, I would have thought, you see, and it shows how little I know your mother, really, I would have thought your mother's reaction would be impatient with anybody who didn't make the best of things and didn't anyone who was sort of irrational in their attitude to their situation. But in fact, she was very tolerant towards Carrie, then, was she?
Yes, because she felt that it wasn't Clary's fault that she had been brought up to expect that anything she cried for, she got, because that's what happened in the family, you see. I don't think that she... I think she got very tired of her too, but she felt that as having been part of the adult surroundings that gave in to this child, she had her share of blame. It's, there's this guilt thing again. She also had a brother, and he died early in the 30s, I think, of septicemia. He was a rather unhappy man. My grandfather, who was a big, handsome, jovial man, was in fact a weakling as far as dominating other people were concerned. And he couldn't really stand up against the women in his family at all, but he bullied his son. So Stan was unhappy. He had a stammer and he was left-handed, and both these things made life at school unhappy for him too. And he married a shrew. So he didn't have a very happy life, poor Stan.
But he got on all right with your mother.
Oh yes, well, she despised him as she despised her father. She despised Stan because he when he had got into fights at school, she used to have to go and finish them for him. But he would strut around at home talking as if he was the cock of the walk, because he was the only boy in the family, you see. My fine, handsome, 6'2" grandfather was terrified of doing anything that didn't conform with what was expected of him. There's one story she used to tell me about him, which I think sums up her feelings about him, that when they had a jam tart, you know, the open plate type jam tart, and he served it, instead of starting in the middle and working out to the edge like anybody else would do, he cut it like that, and he gave the four corner pieces to the children and his wife, and he had the centerpiece with all the jam himself. That obviously stuck bitterly in her mind.
Because that was a very widespread attitude, wasn't it, in Lancashire working class families, that the man must
man
have better
the best,
than
the yeah.
But still...
But that was a bit extreme.
Yes, I quite agree, and not nutritionally necessary at all, or on the reverse, really. Yes. Yes. What was she? What did she actually look like? I mean, this is difficult for you, I suppose, because she looked different at different stages in her life. But I mean, there are some things I suppose one could say about what she looked like. I haven't seen even a photograph of her. So
haven't you?
No.
Oh, I've got one of her when she was about to photogenic in latter life. So I haven't really cherished them. That was my father at about the same time.
Yes.
There are lots of snaps, but
they
don't they?
Yeah.
Good ones. She was about 5'5", 5'6", and she had chestnut hair and green eyes. And
she certainly looks rather handsome here.
Yes.
Did she have a dress sense? I mean, or did she was she careless about dress, really? And one would expect her to be rather careless about
dress. Yes, she was, really. She didn't have she didn't like to be noticeable at all. So she sort of had she tended to dress inconspicuously, except that she would put on scarves and brooches and necklaces and things unnecessarily.
But again, it's complete opposite of the Pankhurst. The Pankhurst was flowing capes, big hats, all that sort of thing, you know. Complete opposite of that, and that one would expect that, wouldn't one?
I used to try and get her to dress up because she could have very successfully, but she wouldn't. No, I can't find anything very useful there.
Was she quite thin?
No, she was always plump.
Was she? Nice photograph, actually. Well, nice photograph of both of them. But, what about speaking? I mean, perhaps I'll leave those on there, shall I? You say she didn't like speaking. What do you think, what was she like as a speaker, do you think?
When I've heard her, she was very good. She began at the beginning. She didn't waste time telling you what she wasn't going to tell you or why she shouldn't be the speaker or, you know.
Yeah, can you imagine that?
And she was concise and had some vivid illustrations of what she was saying, sometimes a bit extreme. You know, sometimes you felt, well, I don't think she should have said that so early in the speech. Perhaps that could have been the punchline. But I never felt any embarrassment when I listened to her speak.
Mm.
I always thought she was a good speaker, but she put a lot of effort and work into it. She wasn't an off-the-cuff speaker. And she was always very nervous.
Was she really? Mm. That's surprising, really, but she gave a tremendous number of speeches in her early days and read out later on, too. Yes. That surprises me, I must say. I suppose, of course, it was unusual for any woman to speak in public, let alone a woman in her position in society to speak in public a lot. So I suppose it must have been a great thing initially. But you'd think she would have got used to it in a way, wouldn't you?
Yes.
But people
don't
shake off
that. No, I don't know that you ever really do you?
No.
And of course, the early speeches, there was very vicious heckling, so that one would always have this feeling that anything might happen.
Yes, of course, yes. Did she go to, for instance, I was invited the other day to the annual gathering of the suffragettes at St. Ermin's Hotel.
Yes, she always
she went to that, did she? Because I really wondered
whether...
Does
it still go on?
Believe it or not, Grace Rowe organises it.
Oh, yes.
But, you see, I would have thought that there'd still be quite a lot of bitterness left behind the whole split business. And I would have thought maybe she might not have wanted to go, but that's not the case, in fact.
No, she did go until perhaps about 10 years before she died. I don't think she went the last few years.
Mm.
And there was bitterness, and you could feel it. And I think that's partly one of the reasons why I tended to shut myself off from this, because I was dragged along to them, and I did feel it.
Because it is a, and again, I can be quite frank with you, I think, it's a rather sectarian world, the whole world of women's organisations, and particularly those with suffragette connections, and enmities last an awful long time, and there's a certain amount of petty-mindedness, which again I imagine she'd have very little patience with, and all those things would lead me to expect that she wouldn't be very happy on these occasions, although there is actually in the heap of manuscripts left behind, I think in the Despard, because she was going to write a life of Mrs. Despard on Wednesday, probably, a rather moving account of her of seeing Mrs. Despard at her birthday meeting, I think, in around about 1924. And I think I'm right in saying, I think you were there.
Yes.
I think she introduced you to her or something. Anyway, clearly very happy that Mrs. Despard was happy to talk to her and so on, because again they disagreed on things. So clearly that's an occasion where what I'm suspecting isn't true. But still, it's a difficult world to move in, I think.
Yes, I would think that she would feel that she ought to go. And that's why she went.
Certainly not out of any self-glorification or concern for her reputation or anything. How did she get on with Sylvia Pankhurst, or didn't she have much to do with her?
She liked Sylvia, much the best of the Pankhursts. They were I don't think they had very close contact, but I did meet Sylvia once or twice. More on a Labour Party.
Do you know whether she actually read Sylvia Pankhurst's history of the movement?
I'm sure she did.
She did write an awfully good history, actually, of the movement. I wonder whether she ever sort of said anything about it. And it's awfully difficult for you to remember things like that, I imagine. But Sylvia, in a way, is the one Pankhurst who moves in the same sort of direction as your mother, though, of course, she goes further left than your mother ever did. Your mother, in a way, I've never read this book of hers, she wrote a little book on consumer movement, didn't she? Now that's incredibly pioneering thing to do at that time, and this was published about 1913 or so, wasn't it? Did she ever talk about that aspect of things very much afterwards?
Yes, she had strong views about, what should we call it, the commercial organisation of life, and I'm sure she would have had plenty to say nowadays about supermarkets and what they're doing to us. I've been looking for that book. I think I must have lent it to somebody. It was called The Woman with the Shopping Basket, wasn't
it? That's right, yes. I must read it. I haven't got around to reading it yet. But, you see, it seems to me in many areas she has the right ideas. If only she could have got it concentrated, either written more books or worked with people to get a powerful organisation going, then everyone would have heard of her. Whereas now, I suspect they haven't, on the whole.
I think that was the real trouble, that she couldn't work with people for long. Because she couldn't compromise. She couldn't... it makes her sound very arrogant, and she certainly wasn't arrogant, but she was quite sure what was the right thing to do, and nothing else would do. And no deviation was possible. And she'd say so. And as I say, she wouldn't tell white lies. And if somebody was trying to explain their point of view at great length and repeating themselves, she would make it quite obvious that, they were repeating themselves. They'd said that, and they weren't making their case any better. Well... If only she'd stuck to writing.
Mm.
Or rather, come back to writing.
Yes, yes. What do you think she could have written? I mean, there's Mrs. Despard and there's her own autobiography. What else could she or would she have done, do you think, if she'd written? And what were you trying to encourage
her to do? Well, we were trying to encourage her to go back to journalism. She used to have a pretty regular column on the Manchester Guardian when they had their miscellany thing on the back page, and it was rather more serious.
Mm.
And that's the sort of thing we wanted her to do.
Certainly, yes, yes.
And there are these young things nowadays writing in the Guardian on women's topics.
Mm.
She could have done that.
She could have done that.
Mm.
Turns out better than they do it.
Mm.
And she could have done it on a very much wider range of issues.
Mm. Mm.
Certainly she would have objected to the idea of a woman's column, wouldn't she?
Oh, yes. Really?
I mean, her interest in politics was total, wasn't it, really?
Mm.
How far right did she go, I should say? I mean, she starts off, obviously, in the Labour Party. Does she stay really enthusiastic for the Labour Party throughout her life?
Well, it was the Independent Labour Party, not the Labour Party.
Yes.
And she was never enthusiastic about the Labour Party because she thought they were a time-serving lot.
I see. Compromising again.
Yes.
Yes.
So she was never a member, but she was always to the left of the centre of the Labour Party in politics. And so was my father.
Was she a Fabian?
Yes.
Because I would have thought she fit very well in that sort of world. But so, do you think she voted Labour all through her life or not?
No, latterly she voted for the women candidates, whatever party they stood for.
Did you?
Yeah.
Mm.
And we had a. We differed about that in the family.
Mm.
I think Father voted Labour all his life.
Mm.
And I had a brief flirtation with the Liberals.
Mm.
Did she ever think of standing herself for Parliament?
Not seriously, I don't think. People talked to her about it and suggested it, but I don't think she ever did.
Mm.
And it would have crucified her if she got in.
Why, do you think?
Well, the time-serving bit again, and the means and the ends.
In a way, she's ideally equipped, isn't she, in the sense she can speak, even if she is nervous, she's intelligent, articulate, can write in journal, in newspapers, believes in women in Parliament. I mean, everything's right, in a
except
way.
Except that she would tell people what she thought when it wasn't politic to do so.
Mm. And she knew that, you think, do you? I mean,
I think she knew that she... Mm. Well, I don't know that she'd put it that way, because that implies that... there is another way to live, you see.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she knew, because George Hardy, Keir Hardy's brother, was a very close friend, and he never got anywhere for the same reasons.
Mm.
And he never pulled his punches, and he never flattened, and he never said half the truth.
Mm.
And Manny Shinwell, who did all those things and who wasn't half as... competent as George and didn't know as much about the mines, for instance, he got all the jobs George Hardy should have had.
I don't realize that.
And, you know, she must have seen from that that she couldn't be a success in Parliament.
I haven't come across George Hardy, actually. He's the brother of Keir
Hardy. The younger brother of Keir Hardy.
And she knew him quite well.
Oh, yes, very well.
I didn't realize that.
Close friend of the family, he and his wife.
I see.
Both dead now.
I see. Were they Glasgow people?
Yes.
I'm not quite clear about where your mother lived at different times. She met your father in Manchester.
Yes, and then after they married, then she lived in Glasgow for 17 years, because that's where he was working.
And then he became managing director, so they came down to Hampstead.
First of all, we lived in North Finchley, and then we went out to Northwood for a brief period, when my father was at the peak of his earning career, which was brought to an abrupt halt when they decided they'd get rid of this uncomfortable managing director. And then we lived in Hampstead until we came here.
I see, yes, yes.
Do you remember, for instance, her attitude in the 1931 crisis, I mean the 1931 election, the national government and all that, Ramsay MacDonald in a sense betraying the party? Mm. I mean, one would expect that would bring out her fury at the Labour Party's compromise more than anything would. Did you remember that as being a moment at all?
Oddly enough, I don't. I remember Father being very contemptuous of Ramsay Mac.
Mm.
I don't remember her being so.
Mm. What about, it's awfully difficult to know how closely she followed politics, but what about the Gates School CND business in the late 50s, you know, where you have the unilateral disarmament movement on the one hand, which in a sense is your mother's type of movement, I would have thought, uncompromising and extremely radical and so on. And Gates School being the statesman, so to speak, fighting it for all it's worth, although very much a Democrat, of course, as well. Mm. Did she have a view about that or not?
Well, she was pro-CND. I don't know whether she accepted Gates School's attitude or not. She was very fond of Harold Wilson.
Was she really?
Yeah.
Well,
I don't think she would be now.
No, that really is surprising.
I feel I must have been rather more absorbed in my own affairs at that time, because I really don't remember.
No, fair enough. Did you say she supported CND? She didn't actually go on marches.
No, she didn't go on marches.
She just sort of agreed with it. That's interesting. Because again, there is a clear line of connection between suffragettes and the CND movement. Mm. I mean, there are people in both movements.
Mm.
Of course, Bertrand Russell, the obvious example, but there are others as well. That's very interesting. So she never, I mean, even though she disagreed with the trade union movement in some ways towards the end of her life, she never actually repudiated the Labour Party, though supporting women candidates, as you say, all the way through. Is there any obituary of her that you think really gets her right? I mean, or could you recommend me to read any memoirs of her or anything like
that?
The
Guardian did a good one.
Did they?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. She didn't keep a scrapbook of her articles or anything like that, did she, in the garden? Because there's no scrapbook there in the Fawcett Library of her articles. I'd just be interested to follow up her views over a fairly long time span. How long was she actually contributing to the Guardian? Was it for quite a long time?
Yes, I think it was. I should think it was up until about the 20s.
Was it?
Mm.
Over her own name?
Yes.
I see. So if I went through the files of the Guardian, I'd find quite a lot of pieces by her up till then. Well, that would, again, interesting, because that would get me through the First World War anyway, which would... Did she actually do any war work in the First World War? I mean, do you remember...
Well, again, when my father was being fuel controller, she stepped into his shoes at B&W's. Mm. I don't think she did anything else. She was passionately anti the war, you see.
Mm. Was she?
Mm. Well, they both were to start with.
Mm. Not a member of the...
They had some Belgians.
Did they?
Call that... war work, yes, they had
did
a
they?
Belgian family living with them.
In Glasgow? Yeah, did they really? Did she join the Union of Democratic Control, for instance, which was the organisation, the peace organisation in a way in the First World War? Edie Morel and people like that, and Mrs. Swanick as well was active in it. And all these things I can pursue, but I just wonder if you happen to know.
I don't think so. I don't remember hearing about it.
Mm. Second World War, she'd presumably be too old. Right? No, would she be too old to do war work?
She did a lot of work in evacuation. I was then in the LCC and involved in evacuating children, and we wanted voluntary helpers, so she became one, and she went out with several batches to the reception areas and sometimes stayed on. Sometimes they asked people to stay on and help sort things out, and she stayed fortnights and so on in various parts of the country.
Was she in the WVS?
No.
But she was certainly enthusiastic, in a sense, well, I can be enthusiastic, for the Second World War, was she? I presume she was vigorously anti-Hitler, actually.
Oh, yes. Yes, I mean, she took the attitude, I suppose most of us did, that there was nothing else that could be done.
Precisely, yes.
One had got to fight.
Yes, and in a way, he's the epitome of everything she knows. I mean, he's irrational, emotional, obscurantist, violent, everything that she would detest, I imagine. Did she, again, feel very strongly about him? And was she, for instance, indignant at the Munich business? And
oh, yes, very.
I imagine
well,
she would
in
be.
The whole family, we started our indignation in Spain, you know, with the Spanish Civil War.
Did you? She never went to Spain or anything like that, presumably, but she just sympathised.